a self-avowed theory queen, according to their own words, and black trans femme abolitionists, I want to share with you two things as way of introduction. The first is that I witnessed, the first is what I witnessed in Che's life yesterday. For the past several months, Gossett has been undertaking a defiant regimen of Muay Thai martial arts, a combination of boxing and kickboxing and body slamming, that when I had heard Che had elected to do this form of training, made me, shall we say, slightly nervous. And I just want to add that, in case anyone's wondering, these matches, the smokers that get started, there are no winners or losers, but Che kicked major ass yesterday and did really amazing. And then after months of this ruthless, excruciating dedication, they had their first fight last night in a crowded room in Midtown Manhattan. The gym where they've been training at and for the past several weeks, going early in the morning, returning home to Brooklyn, before returning again for more sparring in the evening, all while teaching a class on the survey of black transfeminism at Rutgers University while working a full-time job at Barnard, preparing a new manuscript on an underground AIDS activist for publication, and contemplating beginning their doctoral dissertation in the fall centered around blackness, entanglement, animality, and abolition. Amid all this, what I witnessed last night was a spiritual devotion of a true fighter. Perhaps fighters are made, one must undergo, after all, the training, some of which I've just spoken about. But something tells me that fighters are also born. Everything about Gossett's work in the world, to free the world and end it, holding together the possible impossibles and impossible possibles of black, trans, queer thought is evident in a host of their writings, teachings, essays, and articles. And their writing is breathtaking. I want to quote from a recent piece they did in memory of the Chicana X queer artist Laura Aguilar for Freeze magazine that came out less than a month ago. In the image, Gossett writes about one of Aguilar's artworks, "She relinquishes the coordinates of the human as subject and instead becomes another flourishing of the earth's ecological immanence. What is considered aesthetically trespassing and transgressing, the brown and fat queer body, is now given ground, situated. The ground is lateral, horizontal, a landscape. A continuum of animacy is revealed in the landscape she creates in the photograph. A stone boulder resembles embodied flesh. Rather than positioning herself in the photograph as a subject that sovereignly transcends and rules nature around her, Aguilar instead opts for disindividuation and desubjectification. She situates her body within a general ecological field. Her face is turned away from the camera. She blends in with the setting. Body becomes bolder. Here it is not the human we are confronted with, but ecological entanglement. The aesthetic of the settler is quite literally, to borrow from Franz Fanon, put out of the picture. This is not done through an iconography of political violence. Rather, it is almost like a subliminal shift of focus of her lens," end quote. This writing, the gift and brilliance of this writing, leads me to the second thing that I want to say tonight about Gossett, and what I intuit that you will be experiencing throughout the reading. The frenzy and lightning of thoughts and associations imbricated together across a constellation of readings and intertextual summonings. To really rethink what it means to spend one's conscious life immersed and sharing the immersion of constant, unrelenting training and focus. Frank Wilderson III says somewhere, write every sentence with a target in mind. And in Gossett's writings, tweets, conversations, cumulative reckonings with trans, queer, black embodiment, refusing the ruse of not just neoliberalism, but conditional freedoms or unfreedoms, we can begin to learn and know what unfreedom sounds and looks like. Che is reading through Foucault's lectures the same week they purchase and devour a new book by David Marriott, the same week they're teaching and reflecting on their sister Raina Gossett's film, The Atlantic is a Sea of Bones, the same week they are traveling to both of their partners, rereading Spillers, arguing with Moten or Wilderson or Sylvia Winter on such and such a point, defending, rethinking, sharing, making space and time and life a shared space across platforms that is visible in all of their work and all of their sentences. Throughout all, the affect of a fighter, one of love's warriors, and my dear friend, if this doesn't give you a sense of their tremendous activity, mind and soul, I don't know what will, except for the reading that is about to follow. Che is fond of saying, blackness is on the move, and trust me, Che's work, like them, moves, keeps moving, is so very moving. Please help me welcome to the podium our opening night's guest reader, Che Gossett.
Thank you so much. That was like the most intimate and generous introduction I've ever had. I feel like I guess I should take myself more seriously. And I'm like, oh, I'm doing all that stuff. I must be stretched pretty thin, you know? But thank you. You know me so well. And so that's like really beautiful. So I have been working on a kind of like manuscript for a chapbook, and it's my first time doing that type of publication, and I sent it to different publishers, and one of the pieces of feedback I get is we really like this, it was delirious. So just to be prepared for the kind of frenzied, maybe it's like a mirror image of like what my life is like, doing 50 million things. So that could be what this feels like, and I hope it's like a happy delirium. What it actually is I'm kind of always on social media and Twitter, and so what I decided to do was to kind of blur and pull together a lot of my tweets, so it just becomes this almost like stream of consciousness, or an assemblage, and if I wanted to give it a fancy name, I would call it like computational poetics or something. So I'm gonna read. And I hope you enjoy some of it. And thank you for listening to all of it. Friend, happy B-Day. Me, it's actually tomorrow, but thank you. Friend, it is tomorrow in India. Decolonizing time is the best birthday gift. The neuroqueerness of neurodivergence. The neuroqueerness of blackness. We refuse sanity in our sanity's refuse, and the blackness of neuroqueerness. The feeling when an older white cis couple is trying to figure out what your t-shirt means. Too cute to be binary. Towards trans inscrutability. Femme has failed masculinity and faggotry. Femme should reinforce the gender binary, it should corrupt it. Transphobia has always been a value of the establishment left as well as the conservative right. Books that aren't on the queer theory syllabi but need to be, Jared Sexton's Amalgamation Schemes. Trans as being on the run from gender. Black trans as gender's fugitive. You'll go through different romances with different moves and fall in love with them. My Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu instructor's polyamorous philosophy. And the whole reason I started taking jujitsu is so I can like have a excuse to choke, hetero bros without getting in legal trouble. The feeling when writing theory is your version of writing speculative fiction. Happy Trans Day of Opacity. The tautology of cisgender is one of the ultimate alternative facts. Gender never really matches or aligns with assigned sex. Thinking about how to create infrastructures of life beyond romantic relation alone, i.e. thinking about the politics of friendship. We are always already technosexual. The real question for cruising in the end times, could you ever be with someone who doesn't love memes? Trans as gender and ruins. Let's all be ruined together. What happens when we're ruined together? Trans is as blur. Growing a goatee after 8 years of not having one. Lipstick pics to follow. Shave goatee, too much gender trouble. Homonormative folks are like distant cousins when you're a queer separatist. Surrounded by drunk white people wearing Celtics uniforms. Am I having a Boston nightmare? Oh, right, it's St. Patrick's Day. Or Santa Day, or whatever day. LMAO stands for Laughing My Anxiety Off, Anxious Film Realness. This so-called age of trans visibility is really the age of visible absence. When the sensation of missing a book because it's not with you is like the feeling of missing a companion. Trans visibility, trans imperceptibility. I've decided to call my wayward, crooked, unruly, deviant teeth queer and to love them for it. My gender when I'm feeling all fabulous and glamorous, fancy trans. The shower is a site of critical thought. That's just it. Man marries pizza, that's an actual news heading. An actual queer marriage. Trans studies, even trans of color studies, is subtended by black trans women and femmes. Instead of reading trans women's theory or trans women's experience as theory, queer and trans studies have largely just theorized about trans women and femmes' deaths. The feeling when you're running late for a Fred Moten panel, but it's okay because you strike up a conversation with someone who just happens to be Ralph Lemon. The feeling when Ralph Lemon compliments you on your lipstick. Sometimes writing theoretical stuff feels like what I imagine DJing is like, where you put on something on a loop, add a new track, blend and remix, and hopefully generate movement with an audience, hopefully giving them something they can feel. Sign that I've had too much caffeine, I'm on the internet. Sign that I've had too little caffeine, I'm on the internet. Sign that I'm employed, I'm on the internet. Sign that I'm unemployed, I'm on the internet. The feeling when you have heteroagoraphobia, so you summon your queer, trans, and femme ghosts, witches, and angels. The Weeknd and Drake are my favorite problematic sad girls. You never ask for happy books. Whenever I see you coming, it's always like the person slumps in their chair. Which depressing book is it now? Meta read. This actually happened to me. My idea of heaven is a kind of library. Is there such a thing as cock bedazzling? Because there should be. Hard femme speculation. This Halloween, I'm going to be the ghost of my butch masculinity. That content feeling when you unsubscribe from all the email lists. Academic industrial complex be like queer theory TM, trans studies TM, manufacturing genetic knowledge with neither receipts nor reparations. Where's the Tumblr for when academic panels have neither trans women nor trans feminine people? Oh, wait. The T in TERF stands for fascist. Realizing that my intro to Freud actually came from Fanon, Edward Said, and Hortense Villers. The feeling when you read Jose Munoz on Queer Horizons and realize this could be us, but white queer theory is playing. Sexual symbolism and the social life of plants. In the 19th century Britain, sensitive plant was a euphemism for cock. The feeling when you read Jacqueline Rose on Lacan and psychoanalysis and realize this could be us, but Zizek be playing. Gonna write a book about slut theory, perverting philosophy, and eroticizing thought, or, as author said of Bataille, pornographer of the cogito. What if we all cried at the gym? Hard and soft femme realness, liquid femme realness. What is love but the epitome of the pharmacon, healing and poison, dualism that cuts and sutures all at once? Pleasure of the text, when a theorist and writer makes you swoon and takes you with them, absconding thought. Zizek keeps proving my point that he's the Donald Trump of left theory. The feeling when Hotep bros keep talking about gays ain't revolutionary, and it's like, I'm gonna let you finish, but have you read the Huey Newton letter? Which everybody should read, actually. Grief is nonlinear, dysteological, fractured time. Grief makes time dilate and content and condensed inertia. Sad femme for sad femmes. Channeling Jose Munoz, I'd argue that blackness is, quote, that thing that lets us feel that this world is not enough. What if we didn't have to spend all our intellectual energy blackening white thought? Afro-pessimist sustain. Blackness is living dystopia. Blackness is white slash carceral feminist killjoy. Academia as the sunken place. The feeling when white academic queer theory bemoaning anti-normativity just seems like white privilege. What are cats and gaming but the cultural facts of our present temporal genre? Is the rectum straight, winner for best queer rhetorical question, Eve Sedgwick? Taking a class on Hannah Arendt. I'm going to be her Negro problem, though. Reparations. Let's fuck up some commas. Martial arts underneath its praxis and practice is critical theory. Pinocchio is actually a story about artificial intelligence. Jesus as the originary post-human. Zombie is unsynaptic subjectivity. What is the supermoon but the dominant top of the sublunar planetary beings we are? Feminist science studies over here being with, this could be us, but philosophy and science and speculative realism bros be playing. Maybe instead of post-human, we might just be post-human exceptionalism, the exceptionalization and reification of the category of the human. A shock to thought, Deleuze. I'd rather be softness to and of thought. Perhaps thought is best when it's most vulnerable, intimate, and open. White guy in Manhattan walking around with an Occupy Mars t-shirt, peak gentrification and colonization. The Walking Dead makes me think about how for America, while many may perish, white heteropatriarchy must survive the end of the world. If white people like minimalism so much, why don't they just disappear? So I'm going to just end with a more cohesive thing about reading. Books are a companion species. Reading done generously and receptively and promiscuously. Reading as submission. Reading as non-monogamy. And resisting the notion that we must be married to any particular thought style, theory, or philosophy. Reading as polyamory. Haven't we all had so many lovers, and don't we continue to yearn for more? Reading as insatiable desire, as taking in more than one. Reading as being more than one. Reading as scission, reading as torsion, reading as suture, reading as lust, reading as tactile, as fingering the pages with pleasure and anticipation, reading as erotico politics, reading as showing the fiction of the subject-object distinction and their relation of interplay, reading as entanglement, as ontology, as being with, as becoming, as worlding, as individual, as beyond the threshold, as touching feeling. Reading as play and exchange, reading as willing, reading as vulnerability, reading as opening and stretching, reading as anality, reading as whole because there's no whole, reading as non-sovereign, as virality, as contagion, reading as transmission, reading as transference, as being both analyst and analyst and, as projection and interjection, reading as being a bossy bottom. Pleasure of the text, indeed. Thank you.
Let's put our hands together. Thank you so much for that reading. Sometimes you just want to play the game. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you want to pretend like it doesn't even exist at all, or that if you are playing it, you're playing it according to your own laws, in your own way, a private, better way, or at the very worst, at least the way everyone else is playing it. Sometimes this will not suffice. Sometimes even a deluded person, sometimes a person that has been engineered to ask nothing, know nothing, through the longest running crime in history, wants to know a truth. How much truth can I endure? How much truth can you endure? Can we? There is no we. To quote Jared Sexton on Frank Wilderson III's summation of Afro-pessimism, quote, to shit on the inspiration of the personal pronoun we. Frank Wilderson III is, in my opinion, the most dangerous thinker alive to the good and even radical intentions of radical thinking. His gifts as a writer are prodigious enough. His lyrical voice floating between the impossible hard edges of Fanon and the sermonizing grace of James Baldwin. But there's more going on. Wilderson's culture of politics is often felt and experienced in the live wire incendiary device of an anecdote, his preferred unit of thought, a memory, a saying, the happy or unhappy detritus of daily life that he has learned through decades of political organizing, resistance fighting, and coalition work for and to black people, always to treat paradigmatically. That is, to see inside the visible core of things, neither superficially for what is usually too painful and obvious to be named, nor in a constant deferral of oblique and meandering post-structural analysis, a particular dis-ease of post-war mostly white men thinking that I have been enormously susceptible to, not Wilderson. All the people that tell you that life and politics and global capitalism are too complex to name, let alone organize or critique for, to resist the violence of, this, Wilderson's writing tells me, is bullshit. What I'm referring to is the gift of destruction. Isn't that the meaning of abolition that has always pointed to as a relation, not an event? Derrida, piggybacking on Heidegger, wanted to assure his readers that deconstruction was not meant to be destruction. I don't think Wilderson has ever had any qualms about naming his project and the black radical solidarity he is building and unbuilding what he calls rhetorically, and I believe literally, the end of the world. This gift of destruction as destruction lies behind what I've come to see as can be found in Wilderson's work and clarified in the fiercest, most disturbing, and catastrophic terms I have ever read are the rules of the game. Not what people want to see or choose to see or need to see or hope to see, believe or deny, but how is the game of racial capitalism actually played? How has it been played now for at least 600 years in the West? And behind every possible radicalization of non-black thought, Wilderson counters with a further sharpening of the blade. Not how do we end worker exploitation, but how do we free the slave? Not what does it mean to be free, but what does it mean to suffer? Not if we should end the greatest perpetuation of violence in history, that is the white colonial settler slave-owning democracy known as the United States of America, but when? And perhaps most radical of all, not how do we stop white supremacy, but how do we end global anti-blackness? And in setting a fire to all the sacred truths of the left, middle, and right in successive, unrelenting exactitude, if you read him, you are changed. The world is changed forever and entirely. I want everyone to read at least 50 or 100 books that have formed my sense of existing. But the only book I sometimes think lately that is mandatory reading is Frank Wilderson's Red, White, and Black, the cornerstone of Afro-pessimism, the anti-philosophy that he has articulated over the last decades in conversation with Frantz Fanon, Hortense Spiller, Sadia Hartman, Jared Sexton, Achille Nambe, and many others. I could pause here and tell you what it means as a white person to read this work, but I want to avoid that detour by telling you through firsthand experience how I have seen Wilderson's work transform black readers, theorists, prison abolitionists, philosophers, friends, poets, writers, and singers. In the words of Fred Moten, this shit fucks you up. I ask myself often, how is it possible for this work to be so life-changing while simultaneously being absolutely not anything within the genre of life-affirming? One thing that bears stating, on some level, in all of our identities and singular positionalities in the hierarchy of anti-blackness, we all are alive in the aftermath and afterlife of the twin events of modernity, black slavery and indigenous dispossession and genocide. And what Wilderson's work does in his poems, as a lifelong practice, his novels, lectures, essays, memoirs, sit-ins, classrooms, is to honor and hold these twin events of reality and set fire to white humanism at all times, unflinchingly, without stop. How has no one done this triangulation so terribly crystalline before? How can anyone not do that? Please help me welcome a friend and hero, Frank Wilderson III.
Well, I know how Shay felt. Take myself seriously now. Thank you very much for that introduction. Shay, thank you so much for your poems. We have earthquakes in California, but the worst part is the aftershocks, and I feel that your poetry is going to affect me with some serious aftershocks later on today. Thank you all for being here. So let's just get started. I'm going to read a few poems from a chapbook called Sideways Between Stories, and it's... Tonight, I'm organizing this. Am I being heard okay in the back? Mm-hmm. Okay, because I can't see it. Tonight, I've organized this around four themes. So I'll read one or two poems per kind of thematic section. And the first theme would be called Abroad, which deals with my time living in South Africa, where I lived for 5.5 years in the late 80s and early 90s, teaching at three universities and working for the African National Congress. And the second part, and my graduate students think this is a little odd for me because this, the second section is called Love. And if what I always tell them when I'm working on a new manuscript, which I'm working on one right now, and I'm extremely grateful to, I've just met Adam for the first time in person tonight, but we've been exchanging long conversations for, I don't know, it seems like forever, but maybe it's only been a year, and he's been most helpful in my developing this new project. So I normally give a book to them when I'm finishing it or a chapter, and I say, you know, I want you to read this very closely. And if you find the mere scintilla of an affirmation in it, please tell me so I can take it out. They would find it really odd that I have a section called Love here, but don't get your hopes up. And then the third one is Home, which is following on Sadia Hartman and Hortense Spiller's Home is in scare quotes. And then finally, the last section will be death or people without personhood. So, this poem is called Nord Street. And Nord Street was a train station in South Africa and in Johannesburg. And when I lived there, it was just, the Group Areas Act was just ending, it was just becoming a place where black people could go in any door. There was a black door and a white door before. But that's not, the poem isn't really about the train station. There's an informal market outside of Norwich Street station, or at least there was in the 80s and 90s. And one of my students' aunts, who I taught at a university in Soweto called Vista, and one of my students' aunts ran a stall there selling fruit. But next to there was a place called Shell House. And Shell House was a very large office building that I believe was donated by Shell Oil Company to the ANC. It was ANC headquarters. And so this poem is really about the sense of disillusion that I fell into after having arrived in 89 and after the assassination of Chris Hani, who was chief of staff of Mkhonto Busizwe, the arm wing of the African National Congress, and the way in which the moderates in the ANC began to consolidate power and sell out to the West, I began to feel as though the sense that we had, many of us had in the 80s, that this thing was going to go all the way, and that we were going to provide a kind of atmosphere or a regional self-sustaining eco-region which would de-link us from global capital wasn't going to happen. And I could see the handwriting on the wall at that point. So, Norwich Street, I just think I want to adjust this just a little bit. That's it. Well, maybe it's this. Oh, yeah, this one. Okay, great. Okay, there. All right. Norwich Street. Between the ashes of apartheid and what they say is coming are the merchant stalls of Norwich Street Station, where a woman sells bruised fruit. Above the rock and tumble of trains, her feet hold down the earth. Her hands move over late mangoes and pears, turning each imperfection inward against the eye. It is July in Johannesburg. Winter, where from lampposts politicians wait for the wet oblivion of night. In the last seeds of daylight, I fill my bag with apple and guava, attempt nonchalance at the track of stitching under her eye, and say, keep the change, as always. This is not my country. For years, I marked my calendar by two seasons, rain, when jacaranda petals bleed their purple into the soil, and not rain, when waiting for the season of rain. Now it's marked by days of abstinence from this face of scars, a spectacle for my optimism. For though I am aging, the face in my passport still lays claim to me upon demand and shares my unclipped skin. As dusk and the first lampposts flicker and choke like promises, I wonder which locomotive en route to which desert turned its steel into her cheek and tell her how I love the last fruit spoiled on my kitchen table. The next poem is called The Lucky Ones with Shadows. And this is for two people that I worked with and up under in South Africa, but they were also students at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. One was a student in comparative literature, so he was a student in the department where I taught, and the other was a student of social work. But really, these two guys, in the book I call them Jabu and Trevor, because when I was starting to write this book, Incognito, they told me that I couldn't. And so I did it anyway, and I changed their names. and then it came out, and there was this huge ongoing purge of leftists in the ANC, and now they both like the book, so I'm okay, right? You know, but the thing that we both agreed on is that I would never say anything. To fill in the story, they were trained guerrillas in Mkhonto Busizwe, the Spirit of the Nation, and they recruited me into their unit. And so one of the agreements that I did hold to is I didn't write anything in that book that was not already in the public domain about any activities. So they're okay with that. Anyway, on April 10th, the day before my birthday, 1993, Chris Haney, who was chief of staff of the Mkhonto Wesizwe, he was also on the national executive of the ANC, which is the leadership, and he was actually on the national executive with 2,000 delegate votes out of 2,000 delegates. And Mandela had 195. So that gives you an idea of how popular Chris Haney was amongst the lumpens and what we call unskilled workers in South Africa. He was also the Secretary General of the Communist Party. So he was assassinated in a very elaborate plot that I won't get into. But the person who organized this was a woman named Gay Darby Lewis, who ran the Conservative Party in South Africa. And there are a lot of assassinations happening of upper mid-level cadres in the ANC. And so Haney had developed a plan that Mandela did not like, which was to retaliate by hitting personnel and targets on the right for people that got hit on the left. And unfortunately, he became one of the victims of this right-wing brand of assassinations. And it was a very tumultuous moment internal to the ANC, because what Mandela called all leaders of different units in and told them to stand down and not follow through with any of the orders that Chris Haney had said. And so the unit that I worked with, the real names are Heinrich and Tefu, they decided to follow suit anyway. And they tried to assassinate Gay Darby Lewis on the West Rand in the Conservative Party headquarters. The attempt failed, and actually, I won't go into the whole story, but the point is that they got away. The ANC was becoming extremely moderate, and several of them decided that the only way that we were going to continue to mobilize internally in the ANC and to deal with the moderates was if people who were underground came above ground and began to act politically above ground, which would be very difficult to do since they hadn't done that for any time. So what they did is they went back to the site of the rubble of the building that they had thrown hand grenades at, and they threw their student identity documents into the rubble and waited for special branch to come and capture them and then torture them for 6 weeks. After those 6 weeks, they emerged and became active in above-ground politics. So that was the no words for that. So this is called The Lucky Ones with Shadows. And part of the reason why I wrote this poem is because when Heinrich got out of the torture chamber, I met him in a place called Hillbrow, and then we went to a place called Parktown in the northern suburbs for a party for the graduate students of comparative literature, who were all white except for two graduate students. And all the white graduate students just spent the entire party haranguing him for what he did, whereas for me, he was, you know, a hero. So this is The Lucky Ones with Shadows. Sometimes in a country where torture is rife, I think how lucky the school children whose denial is truly plausible, whose sleep is dependent on screams of what they may not become, a nostril punctured by a favorite math pencil, a vulva pinched with sharp tools from the floor of seventh grade, testes crushed by new teachers, part pupils, part objects of pain in rooms darkened with sunlight where they alone are the only students, sponging knowledge free of texts, the lucky ones. They may never know this fraternity of fragments, these dim and flickering lights at night, truant in the streets, ensuring their future, their safe return. Part two, love. So in Lacanian psychoanalysis, when you're dealing with the imaginary, there's this thing where when you fall in love with someone, there's nothing bad about them. No. And then when you're filing for a divorce, there's nothing good about them. So I it's supposed to be a joke, you know, like I tell my students. I said, you all are very hopeful now, but when you get to be my age, it's just divorce and Prozac to look forward to. So, anyway, this sense of a kind of absolute collapse of good and bad didn't really fit. It didn't explain my divorce. And one of my current wife's friends once said to me that she got divorced not, and she didn't feel that her husband was all bad and she was all good. She just felt that at this point in life, their paths had more diverged than converged. And I thought, okay, that really explains what happened. So this is for my first wife, Kamohelo, who I was married to in South Africa. And I didn't know what to call this, and I was reading Brian Matsumi's The Politics of Everyday Fear at the time, so I just called it that, The Politics of Everyday Fear. Since we've parted, I've become one of those people who sat never more than once a childhood at our dining room table. The day after, or perhaps 2 days before, a life in some far-off and unpronounced place I could not imagine. Over broccoli, I'll wait for the phone. Is it in here or somewhere else? Somewhere else, okay. I'll start again. Okay, The Politics of Everyday Fear. Maybe that phone is telling me I'm wrong. We should live in the imaginary. Okay. Okay. This is what Lacan calls punctuation. The session's over, you know. But I'm having a meltdown, you know. All right. Since we've parted, I've become one of those people who sat never more than once a childhood at our dining room table. The day after, or perhaps 2 days before, a life in some far-off and unpronounced place I could not imagine. Over broccoli, roast beef, in early bedtime. They were all 10 years younger or 10 years wiser than their age. They lived sideways between stories. They laughed the loudest, talked the most, ate the least, and drank well past the hour of civilized departure. As though they who lived everywhere had nowhere to go and would sleep on our doorstep to not be turned out into the world. This poem is called The Names We Go By. And it's for Anita, who I'm married to now. In somewhere 1998, I think it was, she's a poet, and we were at Blue Mountain. We both had a residency there at the same time. And at dinner one night, one of the, she grew up, you know, basically at the end of the Depression and then the end of World War II and the 50s. And someone at the table asked her about what life was like in Montana in those days. And then he said, what did they call you? Which was interesting because I didn't know how that question came up. He said, did they call you Anita or did they call you Dolores? And she said, no, they called me Sister. So her parents called her Sister, you know. And I thought she had told me that, you know, they liked her brother who was 1 year older, who could never do anything wrong, and felt that he was the angel. And what happened was that I had that wrong. What she really said is he thought that he was the angel, not that they thought that he was, you know. So this is a poem that kind of sparked from that conversation because I learned some things about her past that I didn't know. And it's called The Names We Go By for Anita. In a time too poor for names, uncles, aunts, your parents, and a brother more angelic than the stars called you Sister. I see that pass before me as night, always night, with flocks of sheep bundling a sky of red dust and ruin. You are there in the deep incomprehension of your kin, beyond broadcasts of depression or war, knowing how the tails of comets to be seen must not be looked upon. From my coast, I practice cartography. I trace your voice for trees twisted by wind. I listen to your eyes for a reason. I grope back the way I came through other loves for a place pulled away by sand and sea, that place our hearts went down for air. Sister, I am here amid the useless prayers, the names we go by. So home is in quotation marks, and it really has to do with the fact that from 1962 to about 1974, with some significant breaks in between, I grew up in a what they called a well-to-do white neighborhood. White neighborhood, yes, well-to-do, I'm not sure about, you know. But the point is that I was always told by my relatives and people how lucky I was. And nothing about those years from 62 to 74 felt like luck to me. So these are poems that deal with that particular era. The first one is Civil Rights. And my mother, who was a very moderate, you know, voted Democratic, but very much not in tune with the Panthers or anything that was happening during that time in terms of radical politics, and never making a confrontational gesture, really surprised me in 1968, when I was 12 years old, by writing this very angry open letter to all the people in Kenwood where we lived. And it was snowing. This was April 4th in Minnesota. And she made my sister and I walk with her. We went to her office and mimeographed this letter off, hundreds of them. And we walked with her through the streets of Kenwood, hand-delivering them this angry letter to all these mailboxes. And so I didn't even think that she would make that kind of response to anything political. And it really kind of shocked me, because she comes from New Orleans. She was a debutante queen and devout Roman Catholic, and brought us up to be really proper. I'm a failure, of course, but that time. It's called Civil Rights. Mother never spoke of slavery. She was born and raised in a debutante ball. But when they killed King, she wrote every blue hair, blonde eye a letter. Like any spring of no reply, winter was late in leaving, and we were her only postage, my sister and I, walking end to end through the seep of slush and the push of wind. No one dabbed a crystalled eye, for she would have no crying. This poem is called Chronicle. And it chronicles because there are several sections to it, 2, 6, 8, and 12. And 2, 6, 8, and 12 are the years of my life that this particular section takes place. So age 2, age 6, age 8, and age 12. And it really has to do with how much there's so much inner turmoil inside a house where all the people in the neighborhood hate you, and you have to live every day as though they're your friends and your neighbors. And so the aggressivity that should be turned outward gets turned inward. So I won't say any more, I'll let the poem speak. But the first stanza, 2, is actually coming from Louisiana to the north. Okay. Chronicle, 2. They smile, tip their hats, lower their shotguns, and let us cross the Mississippi line. Legs dangling from the pickup in front, I don't recall the guns. Mom remembers Dad doing the nothing he could do. Up north, he'll make a career of it. 6. For Halloween, I washed my face and wore my school clothes. Went door to door as a nightmare. 8. At night, Dad builds a fire, feeds it with my clippings. Castro, on parade. Why does my penis stick out more than most? He stares at the rug where embers fall. Lose some weight, it'll go back in. Flags, nations, armies, lots of people get aroused. 12. My sister is 6, and we don't like her. Too cute, too seldom beaten. We're glad her hair's a nappy nigger mess. Mom hides it with a wig. We snatch that wig right off. She rolls in the dirt, holding her head. We stand above her, satisfied as stormtroopers. And the last poem of this section is called Tet. The Tet Offensive of 1968 was a really major moment, partly because in our family, because my uncle, my dad's brother, was in military intelligence and fighting on the ground and then also in military army planes in the air. And, you know, I was a 12-year-old, hate America, everything. And so he was, between the ages of 12 and 14, he'd come up to Minnesota and talk to my dad about how he could guarantee, because of his rank, that I would get into a military academy. And they talk about this, you know, with me there, so I wasn't there, you know. So one of these days, when they're having this conversation about my future at a military academy, I went upstairs and got a copy of Soul on Ice. And I brought it back down, and I started reading passages, you know, just over their conversation. And at one point I read a passage saying, you know, while the average American is waking up in the morning to decide whether or not the dilemma is ham or bacon with the scrambled eggs, the average Vietnamese wakes up with the dilemma of whether they're going to be napalmed or have their village burned, you know. And I just, like, stand in the kitchen and just read this, you know, while they're trying to have their conversation. And at one point, my dad was a professor, and his brother's in military intelligence. So at one point, my uncle just looks at my father and he goes, "This is your doing." I grew up and got some compassion for my uncle. And because I remember listening to, at night, around midnight, many radio stations would broadcast the names of the dead, you know, who died in action that day. And sometimes that would be the first time people would hear about who in their family died. So my parents always listened to that broadcast. And I thought about my aunt, my uncle's wife, listening to this and what she must have felt. It's called Tet. In a gray veil of drizzle, she clears a space where tombstone tongues lick wet leaves, lays the wire and cloth poppies survivor's cell. The last war pushed this graveyard out to the street. He used to laugh, down there, the rain never chills your bones, then hoist his ladder, two eyes of stucco, patch them pronto, those eyes bleeding in the rain. Windshield wipers erase his face each time he laughs or cries or says what's so special about the dead that he betrayed her. I'm going to close with two poems from this section called, I've organized as Death or Persons, People Without Personhood. And a lot of, I won't give a lengthy introduction to this section because a lot of what it's about has been already articulated in Adam Fitzgerald's introduction. But you know, part of my work is to critique the categories of suffering that people on the left take to be universal. And one of the categories of suffering that I learned from Sadia Hartman needs to be severely deconstructed is rape. I mean, when you think about it, in other words, what I'm trying to say in my work is that these so-called universal forms of injury cannot apply to a sentient being who cannot be injured in the collective unconscious of everyone else. If you think about the fact that between something like 1780 and the early 1900s, really a period of about 30 years, less than two generations, 389,000 black slaves were bred like cattle in less than 40 years into 4 million people. So that's a form of captivity that prison and incarceration, words like that, are too puny for, and it's a form of sexual violence that words like rape are absolutely too puny for. It's the breeding of 389,000 people into 4 million people in less than two generations. And when you just stop to think about what kind of mass violence and captivity must happen in order for that kind of population engineering to occur, it's staggering. It's beyond the capability of narrative to actually assess and apprehend. And this sexual violation is the foundation of all American institutions. I mean, the Electoral College would not have been able to elect Jefferson to the White House were it not for the fact that legislation that ended slave importation made South Carolina a very poor state and made Virginia a very rich state because it was involved more in this enslaved breeding than South Carolina. And that's what got Jefferson 26 Electoral College votes, you know, about 41% of the Electoral College votes, which put him over the top for the presidency. So violence is a key point in my theoretical work. And it's to say that you really cannot narrate anti-black violence in a way that is analogous to the violence of other oppressed people. The first poem in this section is The Convocation of Conquest. And those of you who know Césaire know that I stole that title from his poem, Notebooks on Return to My Native Land. And so this is it, The Convocation of Conquest. Although I should say that Césaire is very hopeful that all oppressed people can meet at Convocation of Conquest, and this poem goes in another direction. Although I love Césaire, I must say. Okay. My chair was missing from the table, an oversight, I'm sure. Standing there, I considered the distance we'd walk just to arrive, and the horses apathetic to the prey of their riders, gaining in spite of themselves, with heads so enormous, cold mist fell from their nostrils, fell upon the moon, upon you and me, and the men and women we took from the corners of sleep. One dream, one table, one people with one unnameable loss and no place set even aside. Finally, I will end with a poem called Law Abiding. And this is for so many people, but at the time I was living in the Bay Area at the time of Oscar Grant's murder at a BART station. And it was catalyzed by that particular event, but it's not a unique event, unfortunately, to say the least. Law abiding. Don't slant the story to fit your needs. Bullets been catching hell from niggas long as I've been born. Like apples, okay, you got your few bad bullets. But most work hard and vote. Yes, they vote. And got wives and sweet kids in the clip. Who cradles them when a nigga vamps? Who says what to them? Mrs. Bullitt, I have some bad news for you. Then what? It's about your husband, Mr. John Frederick Bullitt. Or may I call you Frida? Frida John Frederick passed this evening. Now, Frida, be strong, for unsavory are the details. He died in a nigger's spine, crushed on impact. Now, Frida, don't cry. The DA is on it. The judge has been briefed, and your husband's friends are in the streets. Thank you.
So let's just put our hands together again for we're gonna Kay and Frank have been so kind enough to be willing to answer a few questions. So if you have one, maybe we have time for maybe three or four, or something like that. That will be great. And then there will be books for sale, and signings can happen, and conversations, and then there's pizza, right? There's pizza that awaits us. Though I'm sure this is one of the most crowded versions of this room I've ever seen. I don't know how long it'll last, but it will be there. The idea of pizza will be there. So I just maybe kick things off. I wanted to ask a question to both of you. For Frank, I just wanted to know, you know, right now culturally we're seeing a lot of films. I'm thinking of three in particular: Get Out, Black Panther, and Sorry to Bother You. Have you all seen these films? And they seem to be having aspects of a lot of what your work interrogates and thinks about, kind of coming up in the films in different ways. And by the way, Che, if you're interested in talking about this, I would love to hear you talk about it too. And I know talking to you about one of them or some of them, you've kind of talked about this concept of passive revolution in kind of thinking about Gramsci and how a culture at a certain moment might have different aspects of more radical thoughts kind of mentioned as, you know, so I just wondered if you could maybe just talk about either some of the similarities or differences you see with certain kind of black film and cinema that's happening currently in our moment. I know in Red, White, and Black, you spent a lot of time thinking about the kind of different grammars of different black cinema. And then for Che, I had a formulated question, so just give me 1 second to remember this. Well, let's start with that question. And I have it, and I will remember it. So, either of you, yeah.
Yeah, right now they don't have the mic. Thank you for that question. I think that Get Out, Black Panther, and Sorry to Bother You are three very different films on some level. I just saw Sorry to Bother You, so I don't really have a way of thinking about it. I'd be more interested to hear what you have to say about it. I found Get Out to be really interesting and very generative with respect to artistically and also theoretically. I was not at all enamored with Black Panther. I didn't like the portrayal of black masculinity, black femininity, the sense that, if you really kind of think about this at one level of abstraction, the antagonist is not the people after the whatever type of aura that they have, but it's really, the antagonist is really a sense of black resistance. Because it starts off in Los Angeles during the LA Rebellion, and it uses that moment to criminalize black insurgency by having Killmonger be emerging from that. And so it's an anti-black film that uses all black people to get its point across, as far as I'm concerned.
I think I've seen all of those, I felt like they were differently orbiting around a similar set of questions, but using like totally different mediums to do it. So I felt like Get Out gets at this, like almost like thinking about the post-human afterlife of slavery, the second Black Panther. I felt like I guess I you know, I mean, this is a question that you, in your work on cinema and black ethic, really ask, is, you know, like, I guess, you know, why can't black rage be taken seriously, right? So, like, something like the X-Men will stage an ethical question about, like, the mutant, right? But when it comes to blackness and staging an ethical question about the world in an Afrofuturist setting, that still has to be demonized. So, yeah, so that was hard, and also because of the politics of disability, like, you know, we don't often see all black casts. And I guess it also reveals, like, there's no outside to anti-blackness, like, we're still always processing it, too. And what's the kind of cool optimism wrapped up in the idea that this movie, on the basis of the fact that it's an all-black cast, would be different somehow for escape those very issues.
Yeah, exactly.
And the last movie, Boots Riley did. Yeah, I thought that was, like, really interesting. Did you see that?
I did, but I don't feel that I'm kind of unsolid ground about how I think about it.
Like, dealing with it so much that could have felt cliche, but didn't feel like it when I was watching it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it was like I think I really enjoyed it, and it kind of had real black Marxist undertones.
Yeah.
That, and I'm still really thinking about it. And there was a whole animality aspect. So I guess maybe it's people should continue to engage, like, watch the films, and also, I think, you know, read your work about questions of black cinema and what's possible around that and black ethic.
Questions? Does anyone want to ask any questions?
I have a comment.
Sure. There was a question over here, I thought. Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for thank you so much for being here and presenting both your work. It's really incredible experience to hear in person. Frank, I wanted to ask you specifically, moving back to the States from South Africa at that time, like, how do you feel like your work helped you consolidate that grief, and did the end of apartheid in any way feel like more of a triumph than sort of the other civil rights movement? Because for me, I'm always sort of heartbroken by the result of both of them, even though sort of the way that the results are read by, like, the external global community is often seen as, like, more successful in South Africa.
Say the last thing again,
the way that the result is seen by, like, the external global community, given, like, the result of, like, the election of the ANC in South Africa is often just like legible as more successful. How did you consolidate that moving back, and how do you feel that reflected in your poetry?
That's a very good question. So I'm gonna talk a little anecdotally, and because I don't want to go on forever, but you know, one of the things when I said these guys, there was one woman in this group, Sal did not want me to write this book, and I wrote it anyway and changed their names, and but the hardest part for me was something that I knew intellectually, but then I in 1996, at the end, when I returned, and I was, because there was a big purge in ANC, there were 350,000 card-carrying members, and when Hani was assassinated in 93, the next year, actually, the next 12 months was a process through which the moderates began, there was a lot of internecine violence in the party, and a purge of at least 100,000 people were either formally purged or just left because there was just no way with the fall of the Soviet Union and the flow of arms coming from the Soviet Union being dried up and money coming in from the West. I mean, George Bush the first offered us $26 million if we just get rid of all the communists, 50,000 communists in the ANC. I got back and I wanted to write about this. I began teaching in the Compton Unified School District, just trying to figure out what I was going to do. I didn't know I was going to go to grad school and get a PhD, and, you know, that kind of thing. And what I found was that there are parts of Compton where, at the level of infrastructure, especially in schools, were worse than parts of Soweto, part of it, number one. And that the police repression was worse, you know. And the most difficult thing for me was trying to get publishers to accept, A, my hatred for the United States, B, my sense that that apartheid and America are not two different entities, you know, and C, not write a book which has a denouement. In other words, a lot of the critical theory work that I do is about how narrative arcs, plenitude, loss, and then redress or recovery, how that kind of narrative arc cannot apply to blackness, because loss is something that is experienced by people who suffer colonialism or have gender repression or the working class, and black people are all of these things. Okay? So that's important. But absence is a kind of suffering of the slave that doesn't have an originary point of plenitude where something was taken. And I think that, and so what I was seeing at the end of apartheid was not just the consolidation of capitalism, but the way in which the libidinal economy, the collective unconscious of anti-blackness, is far more systemic and far more essential to the organization of life and institutions than is capitalist oppression. And so in that way, being in the United States, which prides itself as being somewhere else, even by people I was hanging out with in the bank in California, you know, it was very difficult for me to get that across. Monetarily, so I lost $50,000 in a publishing contract because I refused to write about how redress could be applied. To, this is my memoir, which is out there, you know, up to the situation I'm talking about. So, and also, it didn't happen at University Press. At University Press, they asked, they read like black, they raised the issue, you know, which is like, well, so what do we do with this, you know? And I'm saying, I told you, the end of the world. I mean, I really don't give a fuck what you do with this. Okay? You know, I'm just using your institution to get my shit back, you know? And, so, thank you for laughing, because they don't laugh. They said, oh, and what contract did you think you had? You know, so that was, and I remember, and the only way, I remember I went on a book tour for, I went to like 50 different cities in like 18 months, and there were four different things. things in New York, and one was at Medgar Evers, and there were 70 people there, and like 60 of them were black. The next night was at NYU, and there were 70 people there, and only 20 were black. And the quality of the engagement was radically different. I mean, the black people in the room were really anxious about what I was saying and how the other people in the audience were feeling about it. The conversation at Medgar Evers was much different. You know, in fact, they said, tomorrow's the election, 2008, who are you going to vote for? And I said, I don't vote. You know, I'm against the president, regardless of who he is. And I said, would you have a ticker tape parade for the first black person dropping his atomic bomb? And people laughed. I tried the same joke at NYU, and it was like a scandal. Okay, so, but the point was that I was able to engage this thing where we could, where I said, I can celebrate. It's just like what you were talking about our representation in films. There's a way we should go to Black Panthers, like, yes, we're there. And then you start to think about it, a hierarchical organization of power in a kingdom, an underground or secret place in Africa where other Africans can't get to, the demonization of Black American insurgency as the sine qua non of the narrative. It's not going to celebrate here. But I'm joyful about the presence. And I'm saying, to the end that there's, I'm joyful about Black joy, but I'm not happy about a Black American president because I'm not against Obama or for someone else. I'm just against the presidency. Why? Because the presidency is essentially an anti-Black institution. And I was, so that was the only space where I could actually have that conversation intellectually without people's emotions taking over and asking people, so what do we do with this? So I felt that it's been a long journey returning. I never intended to return. I really thought we were going to, Soviet tanks were going to roll down, the streets of Victoria. We're going to de-link from political economy, have an exchange economy. We wrote position papers on this, we just organized the entire Southern Catholic region. And the moderates like Mandela simply wanted something else. They wanted articulation with the West, they wanted Black capitalism. But the rand went from $1 to $2.78, like 13 rand per dollar. Okay? And that's a psychic dynamic. That's more than it's an economic dynamic. The economics of South Africa didn't change so much for the plummeting of the rand. What happened is that the currency became blackened. And that showed me that the biblical economy is as essential to institution building and institutional making as is the part of the nuts and bolts of the political economy. That's a very hard thing to get across people on the left in this country. So I spent, to just be direct with your question, I spent about 6 years really kind of wondering where am I going to go next. But then I just decided I'm going to stay here and fight here.
Any last questions? Just maybe one?
I think there's a lot of rope here, so I'm going to pull it out. And I'll just add this on quickly before I hand over the mic. I did remember my question. One of the really amazing, one of the passages in your kind of tweet poem that you were reading that stuck with me was, and forgive me, I'm paraphrasing it, you call it the age of transvisibility, but what if it's actually visible absence? And I was just wondering if you could speak to that more. There's a way in which maybe it shares some of the conversation about just like the joy of representationality, but I think it also there's something maybe actually different about it as well. So I was curious if you could say something about that. And then
I just wanted to kind of comment or question a little bit about what I heard tonight, because I found that there was a way in which what each of you did as poets sort of kind of represented a different kind of historicity, I guess, in terms of who you are and what you're making now. And I think with Che, I felt I simply could have listened all night. It felt like an endless thing, and I felt like it was the internet itself. I mean, it was you shaping it and forming it and being present on it, but it also had this boundlessness
that was so open in this way that the internet felt that, and of course the comment was kind of dazzling and great, and I just wanted more and more even. But Frank, I listening to you, I just thought one thing, when the form of the poetry reading is this thing in which I always wonder, I think about it when I do it, and I think about it when other people do it, like there's the poem, and there's all the discourse around it, you know, and I always wonder about myself and other people, what's the point of the invisible, the vanishing part of the discourse, which sometimes is so much the sweetness of the night, and I couldn't help thinking after what you just said in particular, that perhaps it was deliberate and even political in its way, because I felt like the poems had this kind of almost real ultra-compressed kind of harshness where you just dropped off in a way, and of course I was like, I want that chapbook, I want to look, wait, what did he just say? You know, and it went by really fast, and yet each one was contextualized in a whole history and storytelling, and it was all there, and I wondered, I mean, in a way it can be pedagogical, that is, as somebody who teaches, that's part of what you do, is you give, you know, the pith, and you give the narrative, but I'm wondering, was it deliberately anti-narrative that you gave us so much that anybody who picks up the chapbook won't get?
So I understand your question, but I don't really know how to answer. So I don't stumble bubble, I'll just be honest. So, and you're kind of presenting a problem that I'm facing. Now, I'm writing a book which is deliberately based in theory, but also anecdotal and memoir sense. It's just taking me like a year to figure out what exactly I'm doing, and my agents and other people are waiting, you know, for a long time. So I think that I can tell you something, but by telling you this, I don't want you to think that I always know what I'm doing. Basically, I kind of write three different languages. One is of critical theory, and the other is creative fiction and creative nonfiction. And with poetry, this is, I'll just tell you an anecdote of how this got where it is. There's a poet named David Mura, M-U-R-A, he's a sensitive poet. In 1988, he won the Yale Younger Poets Award. And in the 80s, he and I taught at the Loft for Creative Writing in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we were the only two people of color who were teaching there, and we had a lot of friction with the other creative writing teachers. And so we decided that we would go, we'd have lunch every Thursday, and we would read critical theory. We mainly read Fanon, but we also read Nietzsche and other people, and so it was just the two of us, because Minneapolis is a kind of anti-intellectual place, that we're feeling it, and so we would read it, but then we decided that we didn't want to know how the theory that we were reading was affecting our poetry and our writing, so we both tried to find ways to not look to have it sediment inside of us and to write being informed by it in a way that we could not understand. And so I'll be doing some of those exercises in my own workshops this week. So that's kind of, so there are things that I would know and make an argument for, like In Red, White, Black. And there are things I would know and tell a story about in Incognito. And here, I don't want to know how the theoretical lens and my political beliefs are affecting, are informing this so directly. And so I do certain things to try to not be connected with that. And someone says, it's not like the last meeting I did, made some similar comments. There's an incredible amount of sedimentation in the work, which I never thought about, but that's the process of how it got there. Part of the reason for that is because, I read a lot of poetry in high school and in college, and I found that I was not really liking Senghor very much, but I was really liking Césaire, so that was one thing. And the other was that I just kind of always reread W.S. Merwin's four books from the 1960s, Carrie the Lice, Moving Target, and two others, and And so his, I kind of feel his way of dealing with that era as my way, the way I got to make things.
Yeah, thanks so much for the question about the trouble of transmissibility, and it's something I have been thinking about a lot, and you know, I guess I feel sort of like, you know, on the one hand, there's a ruse of visibility with the idea of transparency, and that, like, you know, how much of visibility is predicated on a certain idea and a regulatory idea of trans as a transparent, normative subject position, and like how much of it is rendering it understandable or legible for cis everybody. And also, there's just to make a plug for a book that my sibling Raina, now Tourmaline, edited, called Trapdoor. It's about the politics of transvisibility, and it's a collective text where artists and theorists, Jean Ricardo, who's in the audience, has a piece in it, and Eric Stanley and Johanna Burton are the other two editors, and it's really about, like, reflecting on the time of transvisibility, and on the one hand, how it hasn't translated into a change in material conditions, so it's been largely symbolic, and hasn't addressed the material kind of violence that people face, continue to face. And on the other hand, how people are sabotaging this actual moment and using it as an opening for something else and turning it on its head. So I think that book is like a way that artists are contemporarily, like, using this moment right now and throwing in the question of grammar and transvisibility, but on our own terms. Part of it, my piece in it is like an interview with Juliana Huxtable about her work and her negotiating, like, being in the art world in this moment, and what it means to feel like your work is being, like, taken up, but also, on the other hand, in a really, like, fetishistic way. So I really recommend that as a text.
Thank you both so much. Thank you both. So we have some refreshments. You will sign some books. And
Yes.
Oh, and we have someone's piece. And thank you so much again. Thank you. Thank you.
Does he look familiar?